If Murray supported the show, I'd be less sick of podcasts.
The Blah Blah Blah.
Sending out good vibes. Good vibes.
Underneath breaths of deep gratitude and prayers for guidance and protection. And put on a didgeridoo and shamanic drumming track. Shivers or vibrations and stuff like that.
Okay, guys, welcome back to the Grimerica Show. Coming at you after a brief hiatus while we were traveling over to Invermere for a little Contact at the Cabin event. And we got Charlie Larson this week talking about Anubis with Graham, or Anubis to the layman. It's an interesting chat. It's a good one.
Oh, yeah, it's great. Yeah, it's an interesting book. What's that?
Your number two podcast, you said?
I think so, yeah.
So we're popping podcast cherries again. They're gentle.
Yeah, it was fun. It was a good, interesting book, man. I like just going deep into one Egyptian deity, you know?
Did you read the whole book?
Yeah. I mean, I kind of skipped some of the end with the actual spell casting. I browsed through it, you know, because when I narrate every day, I have to read word for word, right? So sometimes it's nice just to look at a couple pages and browse through, and, you know, that's a nice...
Not read it.
Not read word for word, right?
Leaf through.
But I listen to it on my voice reader for the most part, the first half.
How's the voice reader come along?
Well, that might be why I was saying Anubis wrong, right? Anubis. I was saying Anubis, I think. And you're like, who's Anubis? Anubis. That's the problem with listening to the computer read stuff to me. I'm going to start saying stuff wrong.
It's a problem, for sure. So how are things over in sunny Saskatchewan?
Oh, it's great. Yeah, it's good. No snow yet. I'm renovating the basement, or just, you know, cleaning it up, tearing it down, and we'll figure out what we're going to do. I'm going to put my office down there. Looking forward to that. Get a proper bookshelf and some stuff in the background, so I don't have to use green screen all the time.
Not the zebra couch.
No, I don't think that'll make it to the office.
You're not gonna have a casting couch.
I might have to have a couch in the office. It's right. A cat napping couch, not a casting
napping couch. Catting couch. Are you fooling around with your cats?
Yeah.
We see Megan and Graham down the aisle.
They both, it's so weird, right? They both jump, like, as soon as I lie down on the couch, they both jump on my chest, and they just sort of vie for, like, chest space.
I bet you like that, don't you?
I do, yeah. Especially in my patty paw, the nipples, you know?
The nipple clip area. Reminds you of the nipple clip days. I digress. So coming back from that was a long drive for you. Was that a 10-hour drive? Did that end up being a 10-hour drive?
Well, probably 12. I mean, by the time I, you know, went back and forth to the airport and stuff. So, yeah.
You made it.
Made it home. Made it home, and I went, came straight home. Yeah, I just made it home that same night. It was a good, it was a nice dry drive with, you know, it wasn't too dark. You know how sometimes if it's cloudy and wet, like it feels like hard to drive at night. This was a nice clear drive. So it felt good.
Yeah, driving at night can be a fucking pain sometimes, especially when you're tired.
Yeah.
Especially when you're tired. I mean, I drove I had to come here, then bring the rental back, then go to the airport. It was just like,
yeah.
Well, I guess you dealt with the airport that day. I was off to the airport Monday and again on Tuesday.
Yeah.
So got the house back last night, but it was a good, nice adventure. It was a nice adventure, albeit, undersold, but we did have a good time. It was nice to get mom out, and we had a time up there. Went to hot springs again.
It was good to know everybody a bit better too. I mean, there was a couple new people, but for the most part, I just getting to know everybody who was here last year. It was great.
Awesome. Yeah. It's nice to see people coming back and see, you know, the positive influence at the events. And cause I mean, Trevor's still doing that practice like every day, you know, it's like part of his, life. Who I started trading meat for weed. So now I get my, for the foreseeable future, I'll trade meat for cannabis.
Wow.
The ultimate.
I don't think you're allowed to say that. Are you? You know, the trade. Why not? Well, you got to pay your taxes in Canada.
For bartering?
Barter tax. I mean, they're taxing tax rebates. So I'm sure they would like to tax you for bartering.
Well, they always tax that kind of stuff.
Here, have a rebate.
It's taxed. Yeah, the taxpayers are sending you some money, but we're going to take some taxes off. Really is something else. But so far, the secondhand economy seems to be okay because you could still, like, you don't have to pay tax. Oh. I mean, they give you a line to declare it on. But
Facebook Marketplace line?
Yeah, I made $1,500 on Facebook Marketplace last year. You already paid tax on that.
It used to be Kijiji, but now Kijiji sucks, so it's Facebook Marketplace.
Tax was paid. Nah, Kijiji's a gold mine now because everyone else on Facebook Marketplace, so you can find some real deals on Kijiji because these older people that are people that aren't on Facebook don't even understand the marketplace scene. So they're like, you know, why ain't this selling? Because your market's been cut down by 80%. You know, Kijiji came and swooped in and took out the classifieds only to get taken out by Facebook. I wonder how that feels.
Yeah, isn't that weird? Because the phenomena for me was like BC, living in BC was always Craigslist. And then Alberta was Kijiji. I'm like, how is it separated that distinctly? Like when you go,
I would say that in BC, Kijiji took over Craigslist a while back.
No. Just recently, I was still using Craigslist. I'm serious. It never made it there. I'll check with some friends.
I need to hear from some BC people that you guys are using fucking Craigslist like it's 1989 and you're looking for a hooker.
1989. Backpage got taken down a long time ago, dude.
Craigslist was the hooker one before the Backpage, wasn't it?
I don't think so.
Anyway.
I don't think it ever was.
You don't think Craigslist was full of hookers? I'm telling you, it was.
Before Backpage.
It has a hooker category. You know, you can get into that, like, as soon as you start seeing W4M and M4M and stuff like that.
What was that again? The personal classifieds, maybe?
It was the hooker classifieds. Just passing off as personals. You know?
Yeah.
Anyway, let's hear from the BC people that you're using Craigslist is still instead of Kijiji. And now probably Marketplace. Because even I got to go to Marketplace sometimes. If I can't find something on Kijiji, I will check Marketplace. But I would say that the market share is still probably 50-50.
I thought somebody just told me recently that now, it was you probably that said it was actually like now it's really quite weighed over to Facebook. So
yeah, but I don't know. It depends what you're looking for. The thing with Facebook is it's got a lot more scams going on. So
yeah. Well, since we were on the topic of the show and all that and the travels, like, should I read an email from one of our long time listeners and friends of the show,
Nikki the dude? A video. Dude coming into my house in the middle of the night. Security camera.
Hey boys, Nikki the dude here for first time, long time. Shout out Cyrus. Sitting here on a flight to Calgary, listening to Grimerica, looking forward to a contact at the cabin weekend with Brandon Powell, Graham, the newlyweds, and a chalet full of new best friends. It seems the subject of titles have become a thing, and welcome to all donors, titled or not. This family of fabulous freaks is the coolest group in podcast history. I appreciate the bestowment of title on this most grateful veteran of our hegemony, old D-Ron term. As I am close enough to be under the lordship of the liberal one, I would humbly accept the title of the ancient Google Hangouts. from one of our most legendary OGs, but failed, the Sage of Grimerica. Darren has also referred to me as the Grimerican Grandpa. And Nikki the Dude may be the original title. So I'm thinking that NTD, the Elder Sage of the Highland Rim on the northern border of Lord Liberal Mike's realm. A little wordy, but covers all the bases. Thank you all for everything that has manifested because of the love and entertainment that Grimerica has given us. Shout out to Pat, our lead driver for the Scablands tours. If a tour needs a fourth van, you may get the opportunity to ride in the Grimbergini. So buy the ticket, take the ride, and shine on, you crazy diamonds. Much love to all, and come hang out with us as you can bring your go-to karaoke and expand your horizons. Good vibes and ramble on, NTD.
Lord Nikki, Lord of the Rim Job.
The Highland Rim.
The Highland Rim Job. Did you see his...
Is that when you do it in a skirt?
No, that's when you do it in a nightgown. Not a nightgown.
The only disappointing from his part of his wizard's robe was that it was a Snoop Dogg robe. I mean, I'm like, I really would like to buy one of them. I'm looking
What's wrong
like
with it being a Snoop Dogg robe? Is it because he's black?
No, it's just... You know, I used to really love the guy, but now I just don't like any celebrity, really. I mean, there's very few that I want to buy their clothing. I mean, I wish it was just an independent creator that had these beautiful, comfy-looking wizard robes. I mean, I've really been looking for it.
I bought
one of the Chinese
manufacturer instead of a pedophile celebrity.
What?
Said you wish it came just from a regular old pedophile clothing manufacturer instead of a pedophile celebrity.
I mean, a sweatshop at least. The minimum. I mean, so I bought one of those Chinese, what do you call those Japanese komodos? A komodo, maybe, you know, and it's like super tight and it wasn't stretchy. And like, so now Maria wears it, you know, I can't even try it.
I tried a nice lightweight robe.
What?
I need the picture of you trying to squeeze into a skin tight fucking komodo. You know, they're supposed to be loose, I think, unless you're...
I know, I thought it would be better, but I guess I need like an extra large.
What color was it?
Red and gold, I think.
You sure it was for dudes?
No, probably not. It doesn't matter to me.
I don't think they make them for dudes. Do they? I mean, if it's the Japanese outfit that I'm thinking of, it's very much for ladies.
It's not like Harajuku girl type thing. It's...
Anyway, how long were you practicing Mr. Roboto for?
Not long, really. I mean, I don't really practice. I just have, you know, once in a while, when I'm driving, you know, I crank the tunes and I sing it. I mean, I love that. I love some of those lyrics. The lyrics are what get me, right? Mr. Roboto lyrics from the 80s. I mean, it's really incredible, right?
You're a big hit. I mean, I'm tempted to play it in this intro.
How can you do that?
Shauna recorded it.
No, he didn't. Did he? Who did?
Shauna.
No way. Oh my God. It's so close to you too. You have access to it. Don't have access to it.
Just right upstairs. Right.
Oh my God. That was a lot of fun. I was fucking vibrating afterwards because I'm trying to get over my fear of, you know, of that kind of stuff, like singing in front of people and just having fun like that, you know.
You guys went quite late, just like you and Brandon take it.
Well, Brandon is amazing. He's just upped his singing by a couple levels since the last time we were there. I mean, really, he's now a singing in a band. I'm like, what, dude? I was going to ask him if he's taking singing lessons because he was out there like, I mean, I was even thinking on the way home, I was like, Brandon, we got to do some like real sappy duets. Like I could do like Careless Whisper with him or Spandau Ballet or something. Like,
there you go. The karaoke cat.
I mean, we could do it.
You guys just kept singing. I said, well, people asked how the karaoke, they were like, well, it really just turned into Graham just practicing singing.
No, Brandon was there too. He was singing more than me, but there was like three or four of us in the end. That was it.
Going hard to the paint.
Well, Alice in Chains. I mean, we're singing some Alice in Chains in the end. It was pretty good. Yeah,
it was good. And then some people peeked out on some mushrooms last night. Seemed to be quite the soiree. I left before the real madness ensued. But seems like I went out a good time. Of course, if people want to check into that, we do have the new mushroom link in the show notes. So get your mushrooms from there. I think they actually chip south of the border now. So
thegoldenteacher.co.
Golden Teacher. Those ones fucked everybody right up. So check it out. Of course, check out contact@thecabin.com if you do want to get onto one of these little trips of ours. We got another one coming up in May with the enigmatic Randall Carlson and Bradley Young, and a few hunting trips coming up next fall. If you want to
come. Well, yeah, you should probably talk about your hunting a bit.
Didn't we do that last week? Did we not? I mean, I got the one boy a deer. He shot his first deer, and we went out for several days of hunting.
No, we must have recorded the night before your massive geese thing or whatever, right? Remember?
The geese thing was fun. We were going back out again this weekend. So
we got into field hunting again then?
Yeah, we got into field hunting, which was a lot of fun and a lot of excitement and a lot of birds. So
do you want to describe it?
Well, it's pretty hard to describe. I mean, there is a video on my Instagram of like just, you know, probably we had several flocks of thousands of geese descending into us. And we shot, I think, a dozen geese and a half a dozen ducks without even any duck calls.
What's the limit on geese?
50.
50? Oh, yeah, I remember.
Per person.
Surprised about that last week, yeah.
We're hoping to get like our first triple digit day this weekend. Because this weekend I was out with a bunch of new first timers, you know, you're shooting at maybe some birds that aren't quite close enough. And but I'm going out with the boys this weekend to the field, the same field with some good blinds. We got our blind game really figured out. We got a bunch of decoys. And I'll be going with my experienced shooting team. So I'm looking forward to that. But we do have some, now that I've like started gobbling up all the gear, I'm going to run some more stuff. You want to come and hunt for a few days. It's like a coming on a Wednesday, hunt Thursday, Friday, Saturday.
And preferably like father and son, or not preferably, but definitely.
But it definitely seems like we had some father son teams this time, and it was a great time. A couple of them said it was the best trip they ever been on. It was a real big bonding experience. Get out in the bush with your boy and shoot some guns and kill some geese. The migratory game hunting license is pretty easy, pretty simple thing to get in Canada. And you don't have to worry about bringing guns and stuff over. I got plenty of shotguns and stuff like that. So it's like $1,800 Canadian, which is nothing if you're an American. And that's like, you know, lodging, hunting, everything. So
that includes like gas and stuff to and from the field, obviously, lodging, hunting, food too, or no?
Yeah, should most of your food. I mean, we're not really eating meals or anything like that. You know, it's going to be a lot of like pizza.
You were cooking some of the game, weren't you?
We cook some of it, but it just sometimes you're home too late. It's usually a lot of fast food. But, you know, hunting is a lot of fast food. This tends to go that way. Maybe if not fast food, it's like
easy food,
packaged food. I mean, it depends what time of year to visit. If it's still nice and warm, then it's not too bad to go barbecue something on the tailgate. But the thing is, when you're hunting, do you really want to go spend an hour barbecuing on the tailgate? Because you know what you're not doing when you're barbecuing on the tailgate?
Hunting?
Not hunting. So
we're dressing or?
Yeah, that time of year, you're down to, you know, less than much. You're down to probably 10 hours a day.
Of light.
Yeah, the day goes by a lot quicker than you think.
Yeah.
So, but it was a good time. Everyone had a good time, and we're going to have a better time next year. There's a few dates available if people want to check that out. And, of course, we have the Randall Carlson thing coming up in May. That's starting to move quickly, so if people want to jump on that, they should. We haven't even linked that to the website yet, have we?
Yeah.
To contact@thecabin.com?
Yeah,
it's on there. Yeah. Go to contact@thecabin.com, sign up. We're already like 15% sold on that, so you want to jump on that before it's too late. And you miss out on this great tour. Here's the other thing. If we get rid of that one sooner than later, maybe we'll do another one in the fall. So you guys don't wait to the last minute. Maybe we'll give you another tour, because we have decided that the Azores thing is going to be in
July,
early 2026, not 2025.
Oh, okay.
Because I remember we were going to do it last year, but Nick can't get the time off now.
In July. I thought he...
Well, we were going to do it next fall, but now he's saying it's got to be in June or July in order for us to utilize the boats.
Oh.
So it'll end up...
It's not going to be 2025 July or June?
He's already saying... He says 2026.
So. Okay. All right.
Yeah, that's a... Probably a bit of a quick turnaround. I mean, I'm still going to need a month or two after he gets back to get a, you know, to really lock it all in and make sure. And but that's coming. So, I mean, go to contact@thecabin.com and sign up for the newsletter, because then you'll know. You'll be the first people to know. The Contact at the Cabin newsletter people will be the first people to know. When that goes on sale. So support the show, grammerica.ca/support, guys, if you can, when you can. We do need support direly. What do we got here? We do have to mention, where did it go? Man, we have
a couple new nobles to mention.
We got a couple new nobles to mention. The first one is Rusty Becker.
I recognize that name.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's from California. He's
been around for a long time.
Rusty.
Maybe I know him from social media or something.
Coming in at $11.11 a month. So thank you for that.
Thanks, Rusty.
Rusty. And now I can't find the. I knew I should have taken a screenshot of it. Da da da. Okay, because we said thanks to Jim Davis last time, right? So we did have a 33.33 donation come in from Michael Frisch. So thank you for that as well. Appreciate it.
Thanks, guys.
Awesome. The other thing we should mention is we do have new contact info as well. We have changed the P.O. box.
Yeah.
So it is on the contact page. You can just go to grammerica.ca/contact. And once you get over there, it'll just take you right to the new place. But if you did get anything returned or anything like that, that is why. We're no longer in Calgary, so it didn't make sense to drive all the way back there to the P.O. box. So we switched it over to a place a little more local, closer anyway. What else you got?
There's a link in the show notes to your hunting trip there, just right at the beginning of the show notes, after all of Charlie's information there.
Charlie.
Yeah. That's about it. I mean, I don't know. We don't really have much. What else? I mean, I can't believe it's only been 20 minutes. I felt like we had lots to talk about, but.
I don't know. Support the show. grammerica.ca/support. We don't have any notes, but. We'd appreciate it. And coming to trip. I mean, we had a fun one this week, and we're still a little bagged from it. I mean, I have people here for like 10 days, it seemed like. I know. Like 10 days straight of entertaining. So it's nice to be able to just sit on the couch without worrying about someone else's not well-being. But you know how it is, and you feel like you're entertaining.
Oh, so yeah.
Everyone made it home safe and sound. And Nikki got home late last night. I took him to the airport yesterday. And I guess we'll have that. We had Tease with us. What's his podcast called again?
Conspiracy Synergy. It's not really a podcast. Well, he's on AM Wake Up every Wednesday. So that would be somewhere to check him out. But yeah, I was going to mention that to you as well, that was part of it was a weird weekend for me to sort of get over, get out of myself, get out of my way, like just be comfortable. Being recorded, because he's probably going to make like a little mini documentary or something, hopefully.
Yeah, it was fun.
He's got a great show, video on Conspiracy Synergy, puts out these awesome videos. He's really trying to bridge waking people up, like the normal people that will watch these videos. And, you know, it's what'd you say?
Rockfin, right?
No, it's his website, actually. I don't know if what platforms his stuff is also on. And t.ca is another, I think that's his other website. So yeah, it was like that and the karaoke, like really just like trying to like not, you know, just get out of my self-consciousness or whatever and just be free and be me. So it was an interesting weekend for me that way. Usually don't like to be fucking recorded or taken pictures of or selfies, like nothing like that. So this is, it was kind of weird.
I seen you there on the side of the thing the one day when I went by. Looking uncomfortable.
Totally trying to look comfortable, but being uncomfortable. I mean, I sang One Night in Bangkok too by Murray Head and nobody knew, not one person knew that song. I'm like, what? It's a classic.
I never heard it.
And then another one, Overkill by Men at Work, was another classic that nobody knew. Actually, a couple people knew that one.
I've never heard of that either. Living in another world, buddy.
Yeah, I'm in a whole other generation, it seems like.
You're a generation behind.
Generation X.
Is that what it is?
Yep.
Generation X'd out. All right. Well, let's leave it at that. You got a bio for Mr. Charlie Larson?
Yeah, he's been practicing witch and eclectic pagan for over 2 decades. Passionate about nature.
Can it be a warlock?
Well, I was wondering that too, but I guess witch can be both genders, I believe. Ancestral magic, energy healing, and shadow work. He's a priest of Anubis? Why all of a sudden is this word giving me problems? And works closely with Hecate and other deities. A leader in his coven since the 2000s. He has written and taught in various online communities since 2016, and he's in California. And his website is AnubisLightAndShadow.com.
Anubis.
His what?
Anubis.
Anubis? Anubis, Ancient Egypt's Lord of Death and Protection, is the name of his book. So if people are interested, I mean, I liked his, you know, his honesty about, like, you know, you got to be careful about all these things, right? He takes it very seriously, which I'm glad to hear that it wasn't just like, oh yeah, you just go, you know, playing around with this stuff, right? You got to be careful. So I appreciate that.
But yeah, you're careful. You practice safe summoning of UFOs. All right, guys, enjoy the chat. Charlie Larson.
Charlie Larson, thanks for joining us. How are you doing tonight?
I am doing well. Thank you for having me on here. I really appreciate it, and I look forward to chatting with you both.
Yeah, yeah, us too. Yeah, this. I mean, when I saw your book, and because we've both been to Egypt now, and we talk about all kinds of stuff, magic and all that, and I thought, you know, let's it's time to kind of talk to somebody about this type of thing. You know, like your book is called Anubis, or did I pronounce that wrong?
You know, it really depends on who you're talking to. Anubis.
Darren already corrected me once. This is the problem with listening to something in a PDF reader. It gives me like the computerized voice, right? Ancient Egypt's Lord of Death and Protection. So I thought, well, let's dig into this a little bit. So yeah, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you again for having me. You know, it's funny. I actually have not been to Egypt, ironically enough, and that's one thing that's kind of in the works, I guess. I am planning ish a trip at cool. some point. So yeah.
It's pretty cool.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a number of places that I definitely want to go, but yeah, I guess I will just kind of briefly talk about who I am, but my sure. name is Charlie Larson, obviously. I am the author of the book. It just came out Monday, the 4th. So it's only been out for a little over a week, but it's a sort of a passion project of mine. I've worked with Anubis for, I don't even know, I've lost track, 2.5 decades or so. This has been a project that I've been working on for a number of years, and a lot of complications kind of made me come back to it and then set it aside for quite a while. And eventually, obviously, came back to it and decided to do it. And so it's been a journey. It's definitely been a journey.
How long did it take since you decided to come back to it?
Let me see. I have sort of lost track of time because on the one hand, it seems like it's been forever. On the other hand, it feels like it's been a whirlwind ride. But I think I formally submitted everything and finished it last year in 2023. So it's been over a year, well over a year, actually. Yeah. But I've worked on it probably for a good 6 or 7 years, which sounds like a long time, but you know, social media has its benefits and drawbacks, but one thing that I guess is kind of good is that you can connect with people kind of all over the world in ways that you may never have before. And so I've been a part of a few online communities where I've had the opportunity to write and teach over the years, and that was one way that I sort of got started with it, because I had a lot of people that were asking me questions about Anubis and saying, you know, you really should write a book about this. You know, this is something that there's a lot of interest in, and you know, you have a lot of knowledge to share. And so I thought about it, I started it, and right about that time I went to a convention or conference for pagans and witches, sort of, and went to this joint session between the editors at Weiser and Llewellyn, and they gave a joint presentation on here's how to write a book if you're interested in this field. And so I went to that. I got kind of excited about it and had a chance to talk to the both of them, and you know, they said, you have kind of a good idea here, and why don't you work on it and come back to us? And so I did. I worked on it. I probably got about halfway through it. And here's one thing about me is I have a lot of thoughts in my head, good and bad, just kind of a lot of self-doubt hit me really hard. And so I put it aside for a number of years. And then, like I said, it was 2023, probably, maybe earlier than that. When I finally decided, you know what, I'm going to do this. And part of it was, well, I think a large part of it was kind of a pact that I had made with Anubis, saying that I'm going to do this one way or the other. Even if nobody wants to pick it up and publish it, I will publish it myself. Mm-hmm. So, it was sort of a in dedication to Anubis in a way. But
well, and like you said, in the book, I mean, there's not a lot of specific books going deep about him in general, right?
Yeah. There are a lot of books about, well, from kind of a historical perspective, there's a ton of books about ancient Egypt, not necessarily about Anubis, but just about ancient Egypt in general. There are actually quite a few books on kind of Egyptian paganism, Egyptian magic, Egyptian spiritualism, things like that, but it's always kind of a broader perspective. Or, you know, it talks about many gods of the pantheon, which is obviously also important, but there aren't a lot. There are a few, but there are not a lot of well-known books out there at the moment about specifically Anubis. So
I think it's an interesting topic, because we need to talk about the afterlife a little bit. Or I mean it's really coming out, you know, like people are I think accepting it a little bit more. Like maybe 10 years ago, 15 years ago, there seemed to be a bit of a battle about, you know, materialism and this and that. But I mean, this being such an older deity as well, I guess, from the Book of the Dead, I guess it goes back quite a ways. And just the work they were putting into protecting people through the afterlife, I mean, it really, to me, it brings context to this whole, the whole thing, you know, that like the ancient cultures have known about this and been dealing with it for so long. I think it will help us just become, you know, able to accept that something else is going on here. You know, it's not just, we're not just gonna, you know,
just right. Talk. Yeah. And at least where I live here in the United States, it's historically been, death has been kind of a taboo subject. Yeah. I think that's changing. I've seen over the last few years, maybe longer than that, I lose track of time, but this shift in perspective, I think people are beginning to, like you said, that there's so much more to this than meets the eye. And I think people's perspectives on it might be changing a little bit slowly. Yeah. It's still an uncomfortable topic, obviously. I can't say that I can pinpoint where that comes from, but there's just a way you look at cultures around the world, and there's just a wealth of fascinating practices and historical information out there about death practices. And so I think there's so much to learn out there, even just beyond your own beliefs and culture.
Yeah. Let's start by learning who Anubis is, because some people might not even know who we're talking about here. Or what,
great question.
Why it would be worth writing a book about him. But the thing is, as soon as everyone's seen like a picture of him, they'd be like, hey, I know that guy.
That's exactly right, though, because I think people recognize him even if they don't know who he is. Because we have, I mean, you watch a documentary on Egypt, kind of a general documentary on Egypt, and you're going to get, exactly, yeah. So you're going to get popular images, symbols, and things. And I think people recognize this deity who has the sort of this canid headed thing. I use canid because a lot of people will say jackal. He's got the head of a jackal, but I don't know. There's debate on whether it's a jackal or Ethiopian wolf or something, but so I use canid. But anyway, a lot of people recognize who he is. And for those who don't know, so Anubis was a deity in ancient Egypt who, thousands of years old, one of the oldest deities in ancient Egypt, and he started as sort of the lord of death, the lord of the dead in ancient Egypt. There's so much to say that I can't even know where to begin about it, but very complex fellow. He's not just the god of the dead, but over time, obviously things shift. You know, you talk about ancient Egypt and what we consider ancient Egypt is actually spanning thousands of years. And within that thousands of years, you have so many changes of leadership, of cultural values and beliefs, and you have historical changes. And so beliefs in the gods and how they were viewed changed a lot. And so over time, Anubis's role shifted a little bit. There's our myths that talk about Osiris, who was originally this god of sort of civilization and agriculture, and through his death and rebirth, he ascended to Lord of the Dead. And Anubis was kind of seen by the people as more of someone who was in charge of, I guess, embalming and mummification. He assisted in Osiris's resurrection. But yeah, anyway, the point is that he's an incredibly complex fellow. There's a lot that people don't know about him. If you dig a little deeper, you find that over time, especially as you blend Egyptian history with the Greeks and the Romans, you find that he was invoked in a lot of magical practices, a lot of spell work, that he had a necromantic cult following in Rome, or the area near Rome, for quite a long time until that was you know,
squashed by the
squashed. Exactly.
So when was that? Was that back at towards the end of the Egyptian dynasties, like in the early BCEs kind of?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Early BCEs or even maybe beyond that. Okay.
Cause yeah. I always hear this timeline reference that blows me away. Cleopatra to the, even just from a mainstream perspective, like from Cleopatra to the pyramids is way longer than from Cleopatra to now.
Yeah. The pyramids were already like, I don't know, 2000, 2500 years old or something like that before Cleopatra was even thought of. Yeah. So yeah. It's just for perspective, because I think, and I was always kind of guilty of this too, before I started really digging into Egypt, is that you look at ancient Egypt as like one thing, and it was sort of unanimous and always that thing. But yeah, so much changed.
So what else is he, how would you describe Anubis as, you know, the embalmer, like, so helping people go into the afterlife, like the basically like, you know, the Lord of Death, like you said, protector of that realm kind of thing. And what are some other attributes that he changed into through cultural shifts?
Yeah. So people would pray to Anubis for protection, in a kind of a number of ways, protecting them in life, but praying for protection in the afterlife. There was a lot of thought. I mean, there's more to Egypt than just death. I think that's what all that's left are, a lot of what's left is, you know, these tombs and artifacts and things. So a lot of what we think of is related to death, but there is far much more to Egypt than death, but it was a very important aspect of their lives and in something that they put a lot of thought into. And so they would, spend a lot of time preparing for that. And so Anubis was petitioned for protection for themselves, maybe for loved ones who were already departed, because it was seen as in the afterlife, once you died, you went on a journey, a very long journey in the afterlife, that sort of ended at this point of judgment. And so throughout that journey, Anubis was their protector and their guide. And so obviously protection and guardianship is one aspect of Anubis. Then once they reached that point of judgment, Anubis presided in what they called the weighing of the heart ceremony, which is where you would take the person's heart representing their soul and weigh it against the feather of Maat. Now, Maat was a goddess and also, well, a personification of she was a goddess and also just a concept of truth, order, justice, balance, that kind of thing. And so the idea was that if your heart was lighter than the feather, you lived a virtuous life, whatever that meant. You could continue on into the afterlife. And if your heart was found to be heavier and more dense than the feather, and you lived, I guess, what was deemed as maybe not such a great life, then your soul would be fed to Amit, who was this sort of dark, I guess if you want to use the word evil, deity. I don't like using the word evil, but this dark deity of looking at the portrayal was this mixture of like the most feared animals in Egypt at that time. So like a lot, it was part lion, part hippopotamus, part crocodile. I only recently kind of thought about that, is that they were some of the most dangerous creatures in Egypt. And so it's like that your soul was fed to this creature. And you just ceased to exist. And so Anubis was not the one who made that final judgment. He wasn't the one who made the call, but he was the one who presided over the ceremony and would assist in that process.
Interesting. So we narrated, we put out on audiobook, the Egyptian Book of the Dead. And it's funny because after reading your book, I was looking at if I kept any notes on that narration, and I kept a note. I was trying to figure out what it was, but it was all the questions that are asked of in
math,
right? Like, and then I know I was flipping through your book and I noticed you had the 42 of them listed as well. So it's almost like the before the commandments, right? It's almost like an earlier version of the commandments. Like, you know,
if you,
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, if you read them, it's kind of from a more broader perspective. It's not too dissimilar from that, I suppose. But what I have in the book is obviously kind of a more simplified version, because if you read the original, it's kind of really complex, because there were 42 truths that you were to utter upon your death before your judgment. And each of those truths was a statement of, I did not do X, Y, and Z, or like, I did not, you know, commit murder. I did not steal someone else's cow. I did whatever it might be. Yeah. I don't know if that's one of them. I don't remember. But anyway,
I have not driven the cattle from their pastures.
Oh. That's right. There was something about a cow I remember. But each one, and if you read it in as it originally is, it's kind of muddy and complex, because each one invokes a particular deity or spirit. And then you are saying to that entity, I have not done whatever. But if you take a step back, kind of the watered down version that I have in the book is, it's kind of just living a, I don't know, truthful, honest life, I guess, is what it comes down to. So.
Yeah, it seems to be very similar to, you know, like, you don't harm people. You're kind of honest and truthful. It's pretty interesting.
Yeah.
So have you ever thought about the, I don't know if I want to go to this other question yet, but Darren, do you have any other questions about Anubis or anything else?
Who's Anubis?
Anubis.
Well, is there any, you talked about the timeline of Egypt, which I would argue goes back even further than thousands of years, to maybe into tens of thousands of years. Is there any evidence for Anubis in the oldest dynasties? You know, the real neat stuff.
You know, everything I find in historical record, kind of points Anubis, a direct reference to Anubis around 3000 to 3500 BCE. But if you go back even farther, even 6000 years BC and before, there are loose associations between jackals and death. Uh-huh. And I've thought about this and read about it. And so jackals were carrion animals that would just pick off of whatever they could find, mostly. And in the early days before embalming practices were put into place and people were buried in tombs or in crypts or whatever, people were kind of just thrown into a shallow grave. And so it was very easy for jackals to just dig up bodies and eat them for sustenance. And so there's not obviously any evidence to this, but one thing I've thought about, just an idea or a thought, is it could have been an early way for people to appease this jackal, don't dig up my dad and eat him, you know. So this prayer, this reverence toward this creature, could have maybe been how this developed, this association between jackals and death, and how a figure such as Anubis, there are other jackal associated deities in Egypt than just Anubis, but it could have been how that began. I don't know.
And vultures too, right? I mean, wasn't there a similarity with some of the carrion that fly?
Yeah, there's a goddess now whose name has escaped me, starts with an N.
Nephthys, not Nephthys.
Nekhbet or something, who is a goddess who is associated with vultures. I mean, there are many. There are so many deities in ancient Egypt, which part of what I was saying earlier with just the complexity in the history and the changing in leadership. And so you go to different points across Egypt in history and you will see kind of sometimes contradictions, or you will see two deities that look very similar or almost identical, but they're different names in different places. And so it's very complicated, but.
So, Darren, I was thinking about the Book of the Dead too, because it supposedly goes way back to the early dynasties. And yet it talks about finding thousands and thousands of, what was the quote I had here? thousands of loaves of bread, thousands of vases of ale, thousands of linen garments, thousands of changes of wearing apparel, and thousands of oxen. So it was weird to me that that's such an early book in Egypt, and yet it was talking about the past, as in that there was thousands of these things. Like, and one of the things we talk about is the vases, thousands of vases that were found that were like very, it seems like they're very accurately made, like precisely made, that go way back further. So I feel like, yeah, like Darren's got a piece right there. But I feel like Anubis as one of the older ones. I mean, it could go back. I mean, they talked even about Atlantis having deities with human and animal hybrids kind of thing. You know, it makes me think about some of that too.
Yeah, there are so many. It's interesting to look at specifically Egypt, and I don't know, there's so many different theories as to why they portray so many of their deities with animals. There are, I mean, cultures around the world connect deities and animals in some way. Often it's a companion or a form that they can morph into or something. But it's a little interesting that it's specifically Egypt portrays their deities as being some kind of humanoid figure with, you know, features of an animal. That has always fascinated me, that it's specifically Egypt. I'm trying to, off the top of my head, don't know that I can think of really any other culture that does something similar to that. To what you were saying about just the timeline again, it's really mind-blowing to think of how expansive, how long of a period of time ancient Egypt really spanned, because even by the days of Cleopatra, most major tombs had already been raided, all of, you know, the goods and the jewels and things had been long gone. So if archaeologists manage to find anything these days, it's kind of lucky, because so many of them are just empty.
Yeah. So what about, I wanted to ask you about, I got the sense from reading it. I don't know if you ever heard of, the Monroe Institute. And, so it's like an institute that trains you to go out of body and go into the astral realm. And they have a program that's called the Soul Rescue, I think. So they go, like, they train people to go into that realm and they find lost souls and make, you know, like basically make them recognize that they're lost, and they'll find their way home, or they'll move on through through that sort of Bardo state, or that limbo. What's the word I'm thinking of?
Purgatory.
Well, yeah, I mean, maybe that's purgatory. I mean, that's why I'm so fascinated by Anubis trying to help people through. Like, maybe they knew that if you don't have assistance through there, you can get stuck in that limbo and just be, you know, stuck in the state where you don't know if you're dead or alive. You're kind of in, like Darren said, maybe that's hell or purgatory, right? Just being stuck there. Mm-hmm. And now here we have these modern, you know, which isn't really accepted by science, but it will be eventually, but these modern programs that teach people how to go rescue souls. I mean, then maybe that's what they were doing back then.
Yeah. That's definitely something I've thought of, and I honestly believe could have been entirely possible. You know, there's a book that has since left the title has since left my memory, that talked about shamanic practices in ancient Egypt. And one thing that I think Anubis, there's a lot. So when I talk about death, it's not always a literal sense of the word, because there's a strong connection, metaphorical connection, with death and transformation. And that's something that I work with Anubis a lot on, because I don't know how much you are interested in or know about astrology, but I have a lot of Scorpio in my chart. And so transformation and death are kind of a theme in my life. I've been through a lot of adverse experiences, and having someone to kind of guide you through that, I think, can be very beneficial. And so that's kind of the work I've done with Anubis. But there's a lot more talk about these sort of, I call it sort of shadow work for your own purposes of sort of the soul retrieval and piecing together, you know, fractured parts of yourself. But there's a lot more talk about it than there used to be. And I find that interesting. I keep seeing more and more and more of it kind of become a mainstream conversation.
The shadow work. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, what about the interest, the increased interest in just Wicca and paganism too? I mean, it seems like, mind you, there's also, I think there's an interest in Christ, not the church, but Christ as a non-denominational kind of thing, but mm-hmm. which in some ways probably fits in with paganism and Wicca a little bit, you know, the Christ consciousness aspect. So, because you've been in this for a while, right? A couple of decades. Have you noticed a huge increase in interest?
In that kind of thing?
Yeah, Wicca and paganism.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. It's interesting to me. I mean, when I was in high school, you could maybe find two books in the bookstore about that kind of thing. And now you go to pretty much any normal bookstore and can find a whole section on, they kind of lump it together with things like astrology and tarot that aren't necessarily towards one practice, but I don't know. There's just an increase in interest in it. And I have a lot of, I don't know. I think people are realizing slowly more and more that there's more to life than what they may have been told growing up. You know, people, I think part of it is because of so many great teachers and authors have been able to share information that people have access to more, maybe in part due to technology, you know, the rise of internet and social media, YouTube, things like that. People have access to this information that maybe they didn't used to.
Yeah.
And I think that's been a huge part of it, but it's interesting. Go ahead.
You think there's a need for like a warning or to tell people to be careful? I mean, I feel like people playing around with this stuff with not realizing what they're actually doing. I feel like that's I'll talk to you more about that. We'll talk to you more about that later. But just in general, do you think people need to be careful and follow sort of an initiation type path?
I think you should approach things. People should approach things with curiosity, but also, if you are brand new to something, especially if you're going to get into any kind of witchcraft or magical practices, working with any kind of deity or spirit, I think there needs to come up with a little bit of a warning label, because you don't know what kind of Pandora's box you're going to open.
Yeah, that's kind of what I'm getting at. Like personally, I kind of draw the line about making contact with anything, really, because how do you know, like, and how do you do this? How do you ensure that you're making contact with Anubis and not something else, you know, like, if you're opening some doors to communication, that to me is kind of scary in a way. I mean, I never used to think that, but now I kind of do.
Yeah. You really have to be careful. I think that's why, you know, there's a lot of people who are solitary practitioners, but I think if you're going to learn this type of thing, you need to have some type of you need to have something to guide you or someone to guide you. I guess, you know, there's a lot of great books and resources out there that could act as sort of a teacher, but I don't think it's quite a replacement for a person having someone in your life. That doesn't mean you have to join a group of people or be, you know, in a sort of group practice with this kind of thing. But I think that you do need someone there to kind of guide you, ask questions, answer questions, you know, kind of steer you in the right direction, so to speak.
What do you recommend yourself? Like, what do? You do protection spells for yourself? Or
yes. Nowadays, anytime I do any type of magical work or working even communicating with this particular deity or spirit, I always have some type of protection. Either, I don't know, some type of stone or amulet or something often is simple, but quite effective. But especially if I'm kind of on the go and want to kind of, I don't know, meditate or communicate with a particular deity.
Do you, what other deities do you communicate with?
Oh, Hecate is one of them. Freya. So here's one thing about me. I don't just work with Egyptian deities. I'm very eclectic in my practices. I've read a lot over the years, and some of it I have kind of absorbed into my own spiritual practices. Some of it maybe not, but I'm very eclectic in nature. So I don't ascribe to one particular path. I don't just work with one particular set of deities. I kind of see them all sort of as, facets of maybe one particular energy, and can work with any number of them as I may want to. But Hecate, Freya, Anubis, I used to work a lot with Bastet, which obviously is also Egyptian, but the Morrigan sometimes.
How have you ever experienced anything else coming through besides what you're trying to make communication with?
I do a lot of work with ancestors, and I have a particular ancestor of mine who likes to pop in at inconvenient times, sort of as a trickster, I suppose. But yeah, that's definitely happened. I don't know that I have any good stories to tell, but it's I don't want to say it's like commonplace, but it does happen.
So. I just speaking of ancestors and witchcraft, I was just reading a book called narrating a book called The Secret Commonwealth about the fairies, fauns, and elves from the 1600s. I guess it's one of the more popular kind of books about fairies and stuff going back to the Scottish Highlands. And I guess there was a witch burn. Apparently they didn't do as many witch burnings. They got away with paganism in the Scottish Highlands, I guess, a little bit easier than some of the rest of Europe and the lower parts of the UK. But there was a witch.
Being a witch, you're getting burning witches.
Like getting caught, getting burned, getting persecuted. Scotland. Yeah, they were a little. I don't want to get into the reasoning, but there was a witch named Dunlop, anyways, that got burnt there. Like, it was in that book. I'm like, I wonder if that's one of my ancestors. And
wow.
I don't know why I'm interested in this. So I want to go back and check. That's my last name. So,
yeah. Wow. That's fascinating. Yeah. I've always wondered, I don't have any proof of this, but if you go back in time, I mean, I know eventually if you go back far enough, your ancestors, that's all they practiced because there wasn't Christianity, but that's going really far back. Yeah, but I always wondered if somewhere more modern, if I had an ancestor, just out of curiosity, that
may have. So what about, like, I do want to touch on, because I think you talk about this in your book a little bit, but one of the problems right now is even when we talk about witchcraft, and like, even though there's a huge increase in interest in this, and especially working with somebody like Anubis, who's like, you know, the god of death. So then all these things like necromancy come together. Like, black is one of the colors, obviously, black and gold. So it comes across as evil, probably, to many people, right? Even witchcraft too. And I like how you address this in the book, and also, you know, how you talk about how it's not, these are just tools to use, right? It's not like these things are evil. They can be used for evil, of course, but it's not like, you know, whoever practices this stuff is evil. Like, can you sort of pare that apart a little bit?
You know, I think witchcraft kind of gets a bad rep from, Christianity, but even more than that, I think also popular media has kind of gave it this bad rep. And I know it's kind of for entertainment purposes, but you know, you look at, I don't know, a movie, for example, and the witch is always the bad character, which I know it's kind of a fantasy representation of it. But I don't know, I think in the back of people's minds, there's always this fear that they're getting into something that they shouldn't. But what I really think is important is to remember that it's just a tool, just as if you are a Christian or just a Christian, you go to a service, they have a certain number of things that they do. You may have, like Catholics, for example, may have incense. They have, you know, the book that they're reading from. Those are tools. They aren't the, I mean, they're just the tools, just in the same that if you're doing witchcraft, the tools, the herbs, the stones, the candles, the energies that you're working with are just the tools. What you do with them is up to you. I mean, so that I think is important to remember. And you have to remember that witchcraft was always seen as such a negative thing because people wanted their voice to be louder. I mean, you know, they wanted their practices to be louder. And I mean, that's a little maybe harsh to say, but
what do you mean by that?
Well, I don't want to get into like any kind of like religious debates or anything like that. But what I'm trying to say is that witchcraft, they were persecuted because I think people saw them as these powerful figures and intimidating figures. And so if I have to squash out these voices for my voice to be more powerful, then right, that's what right. I'm going to do.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Because it's people taking power into their own hands, it seemed like, you know, that's what a lot yeah. of it is. Like, you know, people having the autonomy to alter, you know, their own reality, I guess. And it's
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and that's exactly what witchcraft is it's using the, at least for me, the natural world. I do a lot of witchcraft that involves the natural world. So, you know, the elements, herbs and stones and crystals, and the elements and things. And for me, it's about empowering yourself and making your life or other people's lives better. Obviously, you can take that the other direction and do other things with it. But for me, that's what I choose to do.
Is that the definition of black magic, is using it against people then? Is that what you would consider dark magic or black magic?
Yeah, I don't know that I would call it that, but yeah, that's exactly, you know, you could call it dark magic, baneful magic, I guess, is another thing you could say. I don't know. For me, black is not a bad color. It's not a negative color. It's a color of protection and wholeness and strength more than anything. So I kind of shy away. I really shy away from saying black magic, white magic. I mean, yeah. I know you see a lot of fluffy witchcraft that uses that, but
yeah, I'm just going by like what they've said for thousands of years. They've called it black magic for thousands of years.
Yeah.
So just like the common sort of name for it, you know, but
right.
I guess what I really mean is just evil, acting evil, you know, that kind of stuff. Cause it's, that can be subjective too, but I know that, you know, like some of the theosophists thought it was, I mean, I don't know. How do I say? I don't know. Let's see. There was some pretty bad definitions of black magic and evil magic, you know, anything like using your own will, even like kind of like very, which I would, you know, I have a hard time kind of going that far with it. You know, to me, it would be like harming others or using your power to harm others or that kind of thing. Right. Would be a pretty easy definition for me, but not just like they had some pretty bad definitions in the 1800s.
Yeah. I can't say that I know a ton about the history of things, but definitely I think that there was a lot of exaggeration of what was considered to be evil or black magic. Yeah. It's unfortunately not something I know a ton about.
What about examples of Anubis in your life, like synchronicities or meeting, you know, animal totems, that kind of stuff?
A story that I tell at the beginning of the book that I don't want to give too much away, but I have this is personal to me. And that's one thing that I do kind of explicitly say in the book is that my experience with Anubis or any deity is different than someone else's. And so what may be important to me, what may be a sign or a symbol for me that I associate with Anubis may not be what you commonly read in a book or that someone else experiences. But for me, one thing that I strongly associate with Anubis because of this story is coyotes. And obviously there aren't coyotes in Egypt. There never have been, or at least not the kind of common coyotes that we have here in North America. But every time I see one, it's kind of a rare thing to see them. But I've, the last couple of years, have had the chance to do some traveling around the state with my partner, and I keep running into them in the most random places that I wouldn't necessarily expect them to. And so that's just always a reminder, kind of in the back of my head, that that it's a connection to Anubis for me. But it's funny because you, for me anyway, deities like Hecate are very loud and in my face, and I get a lot of signs from her about it. Literal things like I've seen license plates that have part of the name Hecate in it or something, things like that. But Anubis is, for me anyway, more subtle, and I oftentimes have to get into more of a quiet space to have those kind of connective moments. Which I think is part of the message for me, because I'm a highly anxious person and very much in my head. My brain is always going nonstop. And I think that's part of it, is that learning to kind of be still, be quiet, and quiet my mind.
Yeah. That's good that you can see that and recognize it. Yeah. Awesome.
Yeah.
And what about,
it's interesting that you'd equate the coyote with Anubis, because in a lot of Indian cultures, it's
trickster.
Yeah, trickster or the creator itself, you know, it kind of goes back and forth between those two roles.
Yeah. 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 It definitely is kind of unconventional for me, but, or for most people, but it's definitely something that's kind of a me thing.
Does Anubis not generally have the trickster element to him?
He seems like a straight shooter.
Yeah.
Basically, yeah. From my relationship with him, I guess he's, if you could assign a sense of humor to him, it'd be kind of a dry, witty humor more than anything, but definitely not a trickster sort of being.
Plus, didn't you see a coyote actually like killing prey too at one point? I mean, that's pretty rare, right? To actually see it pounce and to actually get something. I mean, how rare is it to see that?
I know. I've seen videos of other, like foxes, for example, which are more closely related to coyotes. You see them on like documentaries and they just do this little dive thing. I've never in my life seen. I mean, it's rare to see a coyote to begin with, but I was somewhere right along the coast here. I live in California, here in California. Walking through this field, and I look off in the distance, and there's this coyote that just pounced right onto its prey. And I've the only time I've ever seen something like that.
There's a lot of coyotes around my place. It's crazy.
Yeah.
I see a lot of yokes.
You hear them howling at night too, or
they're doing their roll call. And if there's not enough roll calls, then the female's going to heat. They're like actively managing their population at all times. Yeah.
Interesting.
I hear them here, and I'm telling Maria, my girlfriend, I'm like, can't you hear the coyotes? And she's like, no, she just can't. I'm like, I'm sure that I hear coyotes out there, but.
Yeah, we have them here, but I live in a city, and so we don't get them here. But unrelated to this, but during the pandemic, people weren't going out, and so the mountain lions and coyotes were like sneaking into suburbs and towns and things,
getting a little closer.
Yeah, I mean, nobody was out, so
interesting. Darren, you got any questions?
Seem to have evolved pretty well to live alongside the outskirts of human civilization. I mean, we managed to kill all the wolves, but we couldn't put a dent in the coyotes. If nothing else, there's more coyotes than ever.
Yeah.
There's something to be said. I mean, the Indians might have been onto something with that God stuff, you know?
Yeah.
Because even the bears, we managed to kick the shit out of the bears, but that coyote is just still there. Maybe it's the mosquito too. It could be the mosquito or the geese. The geese are also seem to be doing very well.
But, geese survive on anger alone.
Yeah. Yeah. The interesting thing about geese and ducks is that there's like, They're one of those species that they're like thriving on human settlement. So they're like the wheat fields and the corn fields and everything else has them in greater numbers than they've ever been. I mean, mm-hmm. it's quite a phenomenon to see those things flying across the sky. Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I guess you kind of touched on a couple of these, but what are sort of the other, what's, because I guess right away I think of Hades and sort of, is Hades from the Greek mythology? Yeah. So there's sort of these other figures, maybe not even deities, but figures that sort of play that role of Anubis throughout the different cultures. Is there any more? Like, I mean, the big ones to me are death itself with the cloak and the sigh.
Yeah.
And then the Hades guy with the stuff on his eyes that takes you over the river. Mm-hmm. Is there any I'm missing? Or the, because you must have stumbled across some of that in your research as well. Like, the, you're sort of probably always looking for these different instances that could be Anubis, but in different words, right? Different languages.
It's funny you say that, because even in Egypt, you come across multiple deities associated with death who all seem to be very similar. Like I was just saying earlier, you have Anubis, who was at some point seen as the Lord of Death, but then later, as beliefs changed, as, you know, important figures and kings, pharaohs decided this is what we're going to do now. You know, Anubis's role kind of shifted in people's minds. That almost comes across as a contradiction, because you look at it, it's like, what, did he get demoted or something? Like, you know, but then you have other deities in Egypt who are, so there's another deity by the name of Wepoet, who is very similar to Anubis in some ways. And if you look historically, it's in my book, but I have forgotten which is which. One of them was worshipped in one part of Egypt, and then Anubis was in another part of Egypt. And so it's another one of those instances where it's like, is this just a different interpretation of the same thing? They have different names, but similar roles. They look similar. Is this just different interpretations of the same deity?
If that's the case, doesn't it like beg the question of what they're pulling from, that they could get different interpretations?
Yeah, and if you go beyond Egypt, there are canids, dogs, hounds, wolves, jackals of some kind associated with death. Like in, you've got the hellhounds that followed Hecate around. I guess you could call them hellhounds, but there's a culture somewhere in Central America. I can't remember, but there was a black dog that was associated with death, and I can't remember the name of it now. But anyway, there's death deities all over the world, and they're all different, but I don't even want to say they're all similar, because they are all different, because you look at Hades and he's quite different than Anubis. Hades was someone who was often feared, and people would pray to him out of fear rather than sort of, from my personal experience and from a lot of people that I've talked to, see Anubis as more of a, that's not to say that he's needs that he should be taken lightly, but he's more of this kind of gentle figure, more of a
guide.
Yeah. I don't want to say like a kind and caring figure, but he's more of a compassionate figure, and more understanding than not. Again, that's not to say that he should be taken lightly, or that, you know, you just should not, shouldn't approach him with respect, because obviously you should, but,
I find it interesting. Like Darren, you mentioned Hades, and there's the Menta and Sheol. I mean, there's all these words for the where you go, you know, like sort of a hellish environment upon death. And yet it's part of the initiation process as well, that you go in, you become resurrected like a new man, kind of. You can transform, like you said, and Anubis is transformational as well. So it reminds me of the death and resurrection thing as well, you know, like mm-hmm. not actually going dying, but maybe near death experiences or just spiritual transformations as well. That
Yeah. There was a lot of time spent preparing in ancient Egypt, I'm talking about preparing people for the afterlife in the sense that they could have a life in the afterlife. So the reason that they put so much thought and attention into it is that you had to preserve the body so that you had a body to return to in the afterlife. Otherwise, your soul is just going to wander aimlessly and not have right. anywhere to go. And so the reason that they would fill tombs with, you know, not just riches, but everyday things that you would have, they would literally put food into, at least in earlier days, put food into temples so or in tombs so that when you re-entered your body, you would have sustenance. And so there was a lot of thought that went into how this would happen and the process to, after you went through that whole journey that I was just talking about, you know, in the afterlife and having your soul judged, then you could return to that and live a happy afterlife. They would paint these tombs with, at least for those that were rich enough to have a tomb like that, paint these tombs with depictions of kind of everyday things. And so they would paint these, you would have what would look like random figures, but they would literally paint servants on there who would take care of your cattle and servants who were, you know, cooking and doing whatever. So that at least for, like I said, the people who are rich enough to be able to afford this kind of thing, when they woke in the afterlife, they had just kind of a regular life again.
Go ahead.
No, I was going to say that wasn't true for everyone because obviously not everyone was rich enough to afford that kind of thing. So over time, I think that that view shifted because it used to be in the early days that really only the pharaoh or someone that was close to him or an important figurehead had that kind of experience in the afterlife. And so it really did shift over time to where pretty much anybody could get to the afterlife.
Huh, that's interesting. It reminds me of the soul rescue again, you know, like looking back at your body and seeing it's still there kind of would be like, oh, hey, that's me down there. I'm dead.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
So, what about your spell work and stuff? Like, can you talk about any, if you've had any experiences like making contact or also maybe some of your favorite sort of spell work, something like that, that people could. Like if people are interested in making contact with this deity, I mean, your book has it all there, right? You've got sort of two parts. You know, maybe you can talk about your book and the two parts.
Yeah. So I wrote the book kind of as a way for someone to who may not know anything about Anubis to be able to pick it up and have a starting point. So the first, I don't know if it's exactly half, but the first part of the book is more well, there's a little bit of historical information combined with kind of talking about Anubis in his various roles, so it's more you know, information and facts. I talk about kind of each of his different roles and how that was connected to history, because I think that I think looking at history and also looking at myths can be informative. But another thing that I talk about in here is that it's informative, but also you have to kind of look at things from a modern perspective. So, but the reason that they are there is to kind of build that baseline knowledge of who is Anubis in the first place. The second half of the book or second part of the book is more a practical guide into how you can start building a relationship with him. And again, it's meant for anyone, no matter what path you're on. You don't have to be a witch or a pagan, whatever path you're on. You can pick it up and start reaching out to him. So there are, it kind of starts out with how do I recognize when he might be calling to me or I might be getting signs and messages. What does that look like? Then it's kind of building from there of how can I communicate with him? What are some ways that I can do that? And kind of building from there, you can get into spell work. It's optional. I will say that if you're not into witchcraft, if you're not into spell work, don't. You can have a relationship with a deity that is really just based on communicating with one another. It doesn't have to be spell work. And it goes even deeper than that. You kind of build from that. I talk about how you can do more meditative and journey work. You can build an altar or shrine in your home of some kind if you want. And then kind of at the end point, if you really want to dedicate yourself to working with Anubis full time, I guess, or, you know, long term, you can.
And shadow work too in there. Yeah.
Yes, there's a whole bit in there on shadow work, which is a whole, I mean, that's a whole conversation, a whole book in itself, but
yeah.
But again, any of this is, I say this about anything. I said this earlier about my own journey. Take what feels right to you out of it. It's not meant to be I explicitly say this, that this is not the right or wrong way to do something. This is based on my experience and my relationship with Anubis and how I see Anubis. But if something does not work for you, and I'm saying you as in the reader, if this doesn't work for you, then do what does work for you or try something else. Because at the end of the day, I don't, with that kind of warning that I had earlier, that you do kind of have to be careful when you're working with a deity. At the same time, I want to convey the message that Anubis, in particular, I'm talking about Anubis here, is more accessible than you might think. And the important thing is to, as long as you're being, I think, intentional and respectful, then it's maybe not as intimidating as you might think in this case. But anyway, you can go so much deeper than I have in the book with magical practices, with, you know, witchcraft, if you're into that kind of thing, occult practices, if you're into that kind of thing, that I don't even touch on here. But yeah, that's kind of the way that I laid out the book.
This has been great. Where's the best place for people to get the book? I mean, it's only been out a couple of weeks. Is there a website? Is there, where's the best place?
You can, I have all the links on, well, not all of them, but a lot of the links on my website, which is AnubisLightAndShadow.com. But you can find it on any major bookseller. It's on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Books A Million. You can buy it directly from the publisher, Wiser Books. I've even seen it like on Walmart.com, weirdly enough.
that's crazy. Yeah. That's how far we've come now with this, right? It's in Walmart.
I guess so. Yeah, but anyway, I have on my website, AnubisLightAndShadow.com, I've got links to social media if people want to follow me or if you want to order the book, I've got links there. So, yeah.
Awesome, man. Thanks. This has been fun.
Yeah. Thanks, Charlie.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Yeah, good luck with the book.
Let us know when the new book comes out and we'll do it again.
Yeah. I will. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, buddy.
Yeah. Bye. Bye.
And that was a chat with Charlie Larson talking about Anubis, ancient Egypt's Lord of Death and Protection. What'd you think? I mean, you've been reading all the Egypt books.
Yeah. That's good. Yeah, I like it.
Anubis.
I mean, it's crazy because he does have a list of like all Anubis's titles and attributes, and it's pretty crazy, right? He's got himself into everything at one point there.
Dabbling in everything.
Yeah, that those deities dabbling. Like
a catch-all deity.
Yeah, but no, it's good. I like it. I mean, it really reminded me of reading the, obviously, like the Book of the Dead, you know, because he's in there, and the weighing of the heart ceremony and all the questions that you're supposed, or all the statements that you're supposed to say. That's pretty fascinating.
It says in the chats that Anubis is the bastard son of Osiris.
Yeah.
So, unwed love child, Anubis. There you have it. I was going to always wanted to get a ram head and do it as a Urim mount, because with the horns, it kind of looks like Anubis.
I don't know about that. I think it looks more like Baphomet, probably. You better be careful with that one.
This is how I get power.
You're falling for it before I am.
Da, 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 da.
Well, we have a Baphomet show coming up, actually. It was delayed a couple months, and it is going to be fascinating. It's from Heather Lynn on the 26th. So 2 weeks from today is about Baphomet.
There you have it. Baphomet revealed. Anubis battling it out in celebrity death match. Big thanks to Charlie Larson for coming on the show. Big thanks to you guys for listening. Even bigger thanks if you're one of our nobles. And we bow to you if you're one of our lords or ladies. If you want to figure out how to do that, head over to grandamerica.ca/support today. Sign up for a monthly or make a one-time donation. And we will be forever grateful for it. And we'll read your note. We'll read your note if you want to send a note. And if you become a lord or lady, we'll just like do whatever you want, whenever you want. You just like call it.
Should we put a price out there to become a deity? Or?
If you want to become a deity, it's 10 grand. Check.
I had in my head, too.
Money order. Or you could be a god. A god of Grimerica. I mean, how great is that?
Pick out a name.
Nobody's a god yet. So you could be like.
Pick out a name, yeah.
Nobody's even really close. So Grimerica.ca/support. Sign up for a monthly. Whoops. Or make. I've just banged on my desk pretty hard. Or make a one-time donation today. Of course, while you're there, head over to Grimerica, outlaw.ca for other podcasts. We got lots and lots, 300 episodes plus over there if you want to check that out. Adultbrain.ca for all those audiobooks. Contact at the cabin for the trips. There's some cool stuff out there now, some hunting stuff, and a great trip coming up with Randall. You want to sign up for that mailing list because the Azores Atlantis trip is coming. We got Nick. Shout out to Nick, who's over there now doing some amazing groundwork for us. So, I mean, it's going to be fabulous. It's going to be the ultimate Azores trip, I dare say. You know, I don't think there's anything else in the world quite like it.
Oh, yeah. No, it's going to be fresh.
Fresh. So fresh and so clean. So there you have it. I'll leave it at that. We love you guys. Thanks for listening. And we will see you next week.
Somehow I built a rocket ship. Out of the stuff dreams are made and popsicle sticks. Please look at my rocket ship schematics. Tell me it can fly to the moon. Tell me I'm not a lunatic. In my hands I have a gas can and matchsticks. Yes, Earth is my home, but I need a vacation from all the sadness, the chaos and traumatics. I'll let you do the countdown. 3, 2, 1, no hesitation. Thank you.